Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 258, and we're going to have a weird episode this week. So stop the music. Stop. We are not going to have our normal magazine style this week because I received so many corrections and additions to last week's episode about the first aid kit that I thought, rather than just kind of save that for when it fits in, I'm just going to address it head on and add to it. So this episode is going to be a short one to make up for some of the very long ones we've had recently, and we're going to discuss the corrections to the first aid kit, or the suggestions, or whatever word you would like, and then also some additional things that you should consider having in your van as an emergency type of kit that is unrelated to first aid, but is related to the first aid of your vehicle and not getting stuck, which is a very, very good state. But before we jump in here, I need to say a special thank you to Kelly and someone, and Denier, who last week I pronounced her name terribly. So, Denier, you get two shouts out because you told me how to pronounce your name correctly. Also, I want to thank especially Kelly because Kelly made a very large donation and then mentioned that she was poor. And I'm like, no! Folks, if you are struggling financially, please do not donate to the podcast. This is a luxury item and you are going to get the content for free whether you donate or not. However, if you are somebody who is capable of donating and throwing me a few dollars to buy a gallon of diesel, as we call it, that helps keep ads off the podcast, which I think is a good thing for everyone. So if you are one of those people, please consider visiting buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's two T's, not three, not one. And you can make a one-time donation or a recurring donation, which many people do, and I appreciate them especially. But seriously, folks, this is not a money-generating event. That money is simply meant to help support the show and some of the things I buy to demo and, you know, the software and all that stuff. That's the point of this money. You don't have to pay for the content here. So thank you to everyone who has donated. And thank you to those who listen who can't donate. I appreciate you guys as well. All right, now, last week I did a very ambitious thing, which was to put together a van life first aid kit. And I spent a lot of time going over the items and vetting them and making sure they made sense. And I still managed to screw up because that is the nature of humanity. Let us get into that first. If you haven't listened to the episode, go back and listen to last week's episode where I spent a lot of time talking about the things you should have in a first aid kit in your van. And they're not the things that come in a first aid kit. I think the over-the-shelf first aid kits are pretty crappy and pretty generic. And I think if you're living in a van, you need something specific and also more than average because help may be far away. And that was the list I made last week. And I think it's a pretty good list. I did get corrections and suggestions, but they were reasonable and not overwhelming. And I'm very confident that with that list. But I did misstate some things, got a couple of things just flat out wrong, and people had good suggestions. So I would like to go down the list and talk about those. First, two people came to me, Mark and Jess, and said, no, rattlesnake bites are 75 to 80% venomous, not the 10% that you said. And you know what? Yeah, they're absolutely right. I don't know where I got that 10% number from. It was just completely flat out wrong. So to be clear, what we're talking about here is snake bites, specifically in the U.S. Snake bites differ around the world, sometimes are dry. Sometimes the snake bites you but does not leave any venom behind. And that's a trait that has been observed in rattlesnakes, specifically on other snakes like rattlesnakes, like cottonmouths. There's a whole class of snakes like that. But the number is wrong. It's 75 to 80% venomous. So if you get bit by one of these snakes, you should act as though it's venomous. It might not be, but you should act as though it is, and that's the same. The advice on what to do if your snake bit stays the same, which is keep the wound below your heart if possible, cover it up with a gauze or something like that, and get help as soon as you can. Your mission at that point is to get that person to help. That's it. I don't care what else you're doing. Everything else stops. You're getting a snake bit person to help. That is your goal. Now, if you do research on this, you might find out that coral snakes, which are those very colorful ribbon-like snakes that have that thing, the stripes, you have to do this weird little song like yellow and black, friend of Jack, red and yellow, kill a fellow, you know, doesn't matter. The point is, you're taking the person to get help. And yes, there is some evidence that with a coral snake bite, you should use some tourniquet stuff, but that's complicated, and you need to train on that. So after the bite is not the time to figure this stuff out. Take the person and get help. And if on the way, you want to, and I'll mention this a little bit later, get this app and look up what to do for a coral snake bite, you can do that. But my point is that rattlesnake bites do not require any of the traditional TV stuff. Don't do any of that tourniquets and cutting and sucking and all that. Skip all that stuff. Just keep the wound below the heart if possible, and then get to help as soon as you can. So thank you to Mark and Jess for correcting me on that. Okay, another one. Liz, the famous Liz, came to me with two different things, both of which I thought were good advice. One is that naloxone does in fact work, as I said, that if someone presents with an overdose of opioids, if you administer naloxone, it's like it goes away instantly. It is magic. But the part I left out, and I thank Liz for making me do this research, is that it's temporary. Someone ODs. You give them naloxone, they come to, they're probably very angry with you because at that point they're now in a state of withdrawal probably and not very comfortable, but they're no longer in danger of dying. But half an hour later, they might be, because they may have taken so many drugs that it overwhelms the naloxone. And naloxone is temporary, and that's the part I left out. So if you encounter somebody who needs naloxone and you administer it and they come to, your mission is the same as if they were bit by a snake. You are immediately taking them to help, and you're going to monitor them. And if they come back and they start having symptoms again, well, you might want to administer another dose of naloxone if you have it, but I don't know that you will. But just keep in mind that it is a temporary thing. Administering the naloxone is the first step. It is not the last step. So thank you, Liz, for that. Also, Liz pointed out something that's actually in my notes, but I forgot to say. Another thing for Sharpies, and I did mention your first aid kit should have a Sharpie, is that you can use it to circle a wound. And the reason you do that is that it's diagnostic. Let's say you have a bruise or a bite, or there was a spot where there was a tick or whatever, but you have some kind of a lesion and you want to track what it does. It's very common for doctors to tell you to circle the wound with a pen. And a Sharpie is just as good a pen as anything, and, you know, it's more permanent, but that's okay. You don't know what conditions you're going to need to use this under. Do not worry about aesthetics. And the idea is that you circle the wound, and if the wound gets bigger and goes outside the circle you drew, you know that you've got a problem. This thing, whatever it is growing. And if it shrinks, that's also diagnostic. That can mean, okay, maybe this isn't as serious as it could be. There are a number of cases where you would do this, and I think in general, just go ahead and do it. I mean, there's no harm in circling a wound with a Sharpie. Now, even like if it's a stab wound, or a puncture wound, I should say, yeah, you can circle that too, because they can get infected, and while every wound will be a little bit red usually, it gradually grows out from being infected. So if you circle the wound to begin with, you can actually use that to measure. And of course, take pictures. Take pictures of the wound as soon as you can. Take pictures of the wound after it's clean and stable. And then take a picture every day or every 12 hours or whatever and compare them. And you can see if you have a problem. So thank you, Liz. That's a very good thing to say about the Sharpie. And I don't know why I didn't say it in the first place, because it's literally in my notes. Dominic suggested iodine. It's an interesting case. So I did a bit of research in this. Now, iodine is literally just elemental iodine in a tincture. It's a brown liquid that dries purple. It's kind of weird stuff. It used to be very common that everybody would have it in their medicine cabinets, and anytime you got a scrape, you'd put iodine on it. And, you know, you may have heard of betadine. That's similar. That's what they use in hospitals often. When I just had my surgery, I came home covered in the stuff. So it's still used. It's still effective. But it's pretty messy. And I mentioned that it can do some tissue damage, which is true, but it is not that bad. So a bottle of iodine could be effective. If you already have one in your first aid kit, you might as well leave it there. It's messy, and it's not as advanced as the benzalkonium and other things that I mentioned in the list. So It's not the perfect thing, but it's still totally useful, and it's not like hydrogen peroxide that has basically been put aside saying, you know, don't use that. Iodine's like, yes, you can still use this. There may be better things. So thank you very much, Dominic, for pointing that out, because a lot of people have iodine. Also, iodine can be used to purify water, which is something we didn't even talk about, but something to think about. Now, Carrie pointed out KT tape, which I think is maybe redundant, because I think KT stands for kinesiology tape. So KT tape can help. It's like a stretchy tape, and there is a lot of unsupported stuff about using it while you're exercising, like you put it on your arm and it makes your muscles have to flex more. Never mind that part of it. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a first aid use. And yeah, KT tape, because of the way it's structured, can be used to help immobilize limbs. Like if somebody twisted an ankle, you could wrap up that ankle in KT tape and it would help them keep that ankle stable. So that is something that might work for you. I do think it tends to be expensive. An ACE wrap, which I did not include actually, could maybe be a better solution. Those are tricky things, and I probably should have spent more time on that, because I now obviously have an ankle injury. I now have an ankle brace that I got on Amazon for like $30, and that thing is amazing. There's no hard parts in it. The thing is completely made out of fabric, but the way it wraps around your ankle, it really holds it in place. And when I was recovering from this surgery, that brace made me feel a lot more confident. And I feel like that if I twisted my ankle out in the woods, I could put this brace on and then hopefully get my foot into a boot and then get out of the woods, maybe limping, but at least able to do it. I think KT tape is a good thing to have, but I also think that an ACE bandage, or if you are someone like me who apparently has weak ankles, one of these $30 ankle braces might be just worth it to have in the van. The only problem is that they're sized. You have to get one that matches your shoe size. And the first one I bought was simply way too small. I had to get a bigger one. I like the idea. I'm not sure I would use KT tape myself, but if it's something you have anyway, it absolutely can help. So thank you, Carrie. That's good advice. Mike contacted me, and he lives on the seashore and spends time there. And of course, in the south, in the north, but definitely in the south, in the warmer waters, jellyfish stings can be fairly common. There's a jellyfish called the sea nettle that you basically don't see. It has these long, thin tendrils, and they can like wrap across your chest and stuff, and then start stinging you. And it's very uncomfortable. It's not excruciating. We're not talking about the Portuguese man of war thing, and you know, it's just painful. One way that folks deal with that is to use vinegar for it. In fact, I know that at the first aid stations I've seen in the Bahamas, they have vinegar just sitting there that anybody can use. So having a spray bottle of vinegar might not be a terrible idea, especially if you're going to be encountering jellyfish stings. Now, this stuff is not a cure-all. It won't help you with bee stings. It is specifically for jellyfish stings of certain species. If you get stung by a Portuguese man of war, or as they call them in Australia, blue bottles, by the wind sailors, lots of different names for these things. But those things that have that big air bubble kind of jelly thing on top of the water, those you don't want to use vinegar for. If you get stung by one of those, it's much more serious. And spraying those tentacles with vinegar can actually make them all fire at once. So all the little stinging cells that didn't fire, you're going to trigger with the vinegar. So don't use it for those. You see how quickly this gets complicated, and this is why training is so essential. There is no one cure fits all for these situations. But the question is, what do we keep in our first aid kit? And a little spray bottle of vinegar, yeah, it takes up space, but not a terrible thing to have, especially if you live on the seashore. And since we dove in here, let me give you the advice that is official for jellyfish stings. So there's 5 steps. First, get out of the water to prevent drowning if symptoms worsen. The drowning comes because you can go into anaphylactic shock and then you just can't swim and you can't breathe and you drown. Don't do that. That's bad. Number 2, do not rub the area. You're going to want to because you're like, oh, that hurts. But if you rub it, you might be actually triggering more of those cells and you don't want to do that. Number 3, rinse with vinegar if appropriate. Or salt water, but not fresh water. That's important. I'm not exactly sure why. I'm guessing that fresh water will also trigger the cells. And then remove a visible tentacle with tweezers or the edge of a card, and that person who's doing that should wear gloves. Like, you use a credit card to scrape it off, if you can find it. I've been stung many times by jellyfish. I've never had a tentacle still on me. But if you do, be careful holding that and remove it with something that can, like, scrape. And then number five, immerse the part that has been stung in hot water. Now, that's not scalding. That's hot. Hot water in this case is 110 to 113 degrees Fahrenheit or 43 to 45 degrees Celsius, and leave that in that water for 20 to 45 minutes, and that should help with the pain. So, it's a bit much, you know, it's a little deep into this one topic, but yeah, that's the general aid for jellyfish stings, specifically not Portuguese men of war, which, believe it or not, are not that closely related to jellyfish. Their stinging cells are very different. Next, Scott suggested that afterbite should be in there. My criteria for this first aid kit was this was life-saving stuff primarily. I would not call afterbite life-saving, but afterbite can very much be sanity-saving. And there's a bunch of different brands out there that work. I have used Camphophenique for this, and it has been pretty good for me. You're going to have to do some experimenting to see what works for you. A lot of times, the main ingredient is just witch hazel, so you could try just witch hazel, but do some research on what works for you. But yes, this I would consider more of a toiletry kit item than a first aid kit item, but sure, put it in there, and it will definitely help you feel better, especially if you're having trouble sleeping. That can be a big help. Oh, and this is very important. I'm correcting myself here. Last week, I presented the big list of everything in the first aid kit, and I had a compass linked in there, and I was amazed at this compass. It's $299. It's a very heavy-duty metal compass with a carabiner, and it's liquid-filled, which is good for a compass that dampens it so it doesn't shake. And it's $299. I was like, I was going to just buy a case of these and hand them out. I mean, I was going to put them on my jackets. Then I just noticed something. They don't point north, which is kind of a criteria for compasses, especially, I mean, they have to at least kind of point at least towards magnetic north a little bit. Yeah, these things, unfortunately, unless they're sitting on a completely level surface, meaning you're not holding it, they bind up. And it is very easy to make them put north wherever you want it. So I can't recommend these. I've taken the link off, and I apologize if anybody purchased these. If you are out money on these, I will be happy to cover you for that, because this is not something I should have recommended. But I thought, hey, it's a compass. How bad can it be? Well, it turns out that this compass is all hat and no cattle, as they say. So yeah, no, don't buy that. But yeah, do put a compass in there for all the reasons I mentioned last week. Okay, Jess mentioned something that is on my list I forgot to mention. You need a way to make fire. No, if this is a first aid issue. This is not just a survival issue. If you need to sterilize a blade or a needle, a fire is a good way to do it. So there needs to be either waterproof matches or a lighter or something like that. In my defense, it was a very long list. But thank you, Jess. Yes, we need to have fire in there. Repro suggested something interesting that I actually do have in my personal kit, and that is caffeine tablets. So there are times where staying awake is a life or death thing. Maybe you have to drive. For example, maybe you're a couple, and your partner has been injured somehow, and you spent all day stabilizing them and getting them back to the van. You've been up for 24 hours, and now you have to drive 3 hours to the hospital. Well, caffeine pills could help. Caffeine pills, I think basically each one is either one cup or two cups of coffee, whichever dosage you get. You don't even have to like coffee, you just take them. And if you're not someone who drinks caffeine often, you will get a great effect from these very quickly. And if you're somebody like me who is completely addicted to coffee, and for some reason you run out of coffee or you need to go without coffee for a while, you can take these pills to stave off any side effects of withdrawal, which, you know, typically is headaches. So, yeah. Caffeine pills are cheap. I would toss them in there. I think that was a good suggestion. So thank you, Repro. That was a good one. And John, who is a person who does excellent research, because I have come to know him, even though we've never met. I see him online all the time, and this is a guy who is very careful about his research. So anything he says, I pay attention to. He says that the cheapest place to get loratadine or Claritin, as it's normally called, the non-drowsy allergy relief medication that some people swear by, is at Costco, where you can buy a year's supply for $11.49. That stuff can be very expensive, so that's a very good bit of advice here. If you have a Costco membership, that's where you could get those. Whew. So, thank you, everybody. for all the feedback on the first aid kit stuff. I really appreciate all the feedback I get, and you guys have always been very supportive and very helpful. And that's good. This is collaborative, and we are creating here a really, really robust first aid kit. So thanks again. And now I'm going to jump to a different topic, but a related one. We're just going to call that the episode, basically. And that topic is, what are some things you should bring with you in your van that maybe you didn't think of? You think you're all set in your van. And, you know, I can see John right now is taking notes, because I bet he's going to have all the stuff that I'm going to suggest. But here is a general list of stuff you should have in your van at all times, regardless of whether you think you're going to need it or not. This is stuff that you will probably need that you're not planning for. So, it's broken down into sections. One of those sections is core tools. I talked about the Leatherman. You definitely want a quality multi-tool. Quality, not something you got for 20 bucks. You are going to rely on this to do more than it's supposedly capable of in some ways. You don't want to cheap out on this. So, make sure you have a good quality multi-tool that has knives, a file, some sort of a screwdriver set up, and a pry tool. Those are all good things, but any of the other tools are great too. But especially you want needle nose pliers with some kind of a cutter. Those are the important tools. They almost all have those things, but make sure you get a quality one. You want to get an adjustable wrench, maybe two, a small one and a big one. Adjustable wrenches are terrible tools. They're one of these things you should never use, except they are the best tool if that's what you have and you have nothing else. To replace a crescent wrench, as they are colloquially called, with an entire set of wrenches takes up too much space, it's too much money, it's too much weight for many things, so that's why these wrenches exist. But get a couple and make sure they're not the very, very cheapest ones, because those slip terribly. So spend a little bit of money on them. I find like the Home Depot and Lowe's branded tools are pretty good for this. You know, if you're a professional mechanic, you would want something better. But for this use, those aren't bad. You do want socket sets, basic metric and imperial, because in your build, the vehicle might be one and then your build might be another. Now, if you're in Europe, you're probably all metric. But in the U.S., you're going to find a combination of metric and SAE, which is annoying, but that's the world we live in. So a couple of socket sets there. These do not have to be super expensive. You can buy cheaper sets for an emergency use. You'll find that the sockets, you know, break if you put too much force on them and, all that stuff. But this is for emergency. So, yeah, you could get some of the cheaper ones. You also want a hex Allen key set. You know, those little wrenches that come from IKEA that you build furniture with. You want to have a couple of sets of those, metric and SAE, because you will run into those things on a whole bunch of different things. Also, and this is true for Mercedes especially, make sure you get any special things for your particular vehicle. Like in my Sprinter, I need to have all these Torx bits, very big ones, because a lot of the stuff in the Sprinter is put together with those. And then on the Sprinter, there are these weird inverted Torx bits that have a name that I've forgotten, but it looks like the bit is the screw, and it's complicated, but it's the opposite of a Torx wrench. There's a bunch of those in the Sprinter. You can usually cheat those with just regular sockets, but make sure you do have that vehicle-specific stuff. Vice Grips, which is a brand name for locking pliers. Lots and lots and lots of uses for these. So often I will find some fairly cheap ones that come in sets of three for like $5 or something. I buy those and just toss them in there because they can come in handy. And having more than one is a good thing if you need to clamp something down. Also, channel locks or pliers, get bigger ones than maybe you would think. So those could be super handy for plumbing fittings and things like that. You're not going to be able to do much with a crescent wrench usually. You want some kind of a utility knife, and that can take any form. This list I'm using says duct tape. Screw duct tape. No duct tape. Duct tape is not a good thing, even for ducts, because it's duct, D-U-C-K, not D-U-C-T. I'm not getting into that again. But no, Gorilla tape, gaffer's tape, something like that that's much stronger is better than duct tape for emergency stuff. So have some of that in there. Electrical tape, regular black electrical tape, you can fix electrical stuff with that temporarily. You know, any kind of connection or whatever, you can always do it with that tape. And you have to know how to use it. Electrical tape is used differently than most tapes. You don't, like, you know, wrap it around and then cut it. You wrap it around under pressure. The point with electrical tape is you want to stretch it as you're using it. And then when you get to the end, you want to cut it a little bit and then stretch it such that it rips off. So you maintain that tension on whatever the heck you're wrapping it around. So, yeah, I mean, actually practice that with the electrical tape. It's, you don't use it like Scotch tape. It wants to be under pressure. It's more like KT tape, actually. Okay, zip ties, whole bunch of zip ties. That is self-explanatory. And then you need some kind of a light. Now, you know, all of us have cell phones that have lights in them, but a headlamp that you had in this kit would be very useful because you can always use a headlamp no matter where you're working. That's like your toolbox. Now, the vehicle-specific items, you want a tire repair kit. I've talked about that before. Tire repair kits are permanent repairs, believe it or not. There's two basic kinds that I've seen. One is you make a hole, stab the tire with this gooey string, basically, with this T-handle thing, and then you pull that out. That's the kind I use. They work pretty well. But I've also got these weird rubber screw things that are covered in goo that I haven't had a chance to try yet. I talked about them many episodes ago, but they were pretty cheap, and you put them in with a drill gun, you know, just like a battery-powered hand drill. You find the hole, and you just screw this in there. And then, supposedly, that fixes it. I would definitely give that a try, and they're cheap. So I have them in my van, but I haven't had a chance to use them yet. If something goes bad, and I do use one, I will let you know how that works. You want some kind of an air compressor to pump up tires. I love the battery-powered ones, and I say, hey, folks, pick a brand, and then buy everything that uses the same battery. They have air compressors, you know, there's DeWalt and Ryobi, and I like Works, W-O-R-X, that's the brand I've been buying lately. Their handheld air compressor is really good. You want fuses of all the types that you have, you know, and there's a lot of them now. ATC fuses used to be one type of fuse, and now they're like seven. And then there's those glass fuses. There's slow blow and quick blow, and there's actually a lot to learn about fuses, but you want to make sure you have a collection that fits your particular case. Jump cables or a lithium jump starter, depending on your circumstances. My van is weird in that it has two starter batteries, and I can actually jump one from the other, so jumper cables will help me out most of the time in my van. But those lithium jump starter packs are great. They really do work. You do have to keep them charged, but they're an option too. But you want something like that because you're camping out in the woods, you accidentally leave something on and your starter battery is dead, you're really in big trouble for something fairly simple. Anyway, we've talked a lot about ways around that, but that should be on the list. A spare serpentine belt. Yeah, this is actually not a bad one. It's not that hard for your serpentine belt to fail. If you're in an older van especially, you're going to need to replace this thing at some point. You know, just go ahead and buy it and keep it well protected. That way, if your serpentine belt breaks, you have one with you at least, and even if you don't know how to put it on yourself, you have the part where, you know, if you're in some rural place in New Mexico and you roll in with your Sprinter van and you don't have a serpentine belt, they may not be able to get one for days and days and days. So having that with you is a great idea. Radiator hose repair tape or self-fusing silicone tape. Yeah, you could probably get away with the Gorilla tape for this, but radiator hose tape is a special thing to... If your radiator hose leaks, you basically will wrap it up with this. I do think that the Gorilla tape would do good enough for you to get somewhere to actually do a better repair of that. But if you want to buy that special stuff, sure, go ahead. You should have spare fluids of every fluid you need. Brake fluid, coolant, oil. Coolant, you can replace that with water in an emergency, but any of the spare fluids you can is a good idea because now it's all very specialized. You know, you can't just use any old brake fluid or any old coolant or any old oil. You need the exact thing for your vehicle. So having some of that is a good idea. And work gloves. Maybe the things you're working on are going to be hot. So I like mechanics style gloves. They're very flexible leather and some kind of synthetic tech. And you know, they're not stiff. You can use your hands in them and they offer a decent amount of protection. Okay, now for electrical, you want to have everything you need to make an electrical repair. You're going to want to have wire strippers and crimpers. You know, you could just get one of those cheap kits that has all that. And you want the assorted wire connectors. I would just buy a whole big kit of either Wago or fake Wago connectors and keep them in the van because, boy, you can do a lot with those. I really like those. I don't think I will ever use a butt connector ever again unless I have to. You do want some spare wire. Now, the recommendation list I'm looking at says 12 to 16 gauge. Yeah, okay, 12, I would at least get 12. 10 is better, but it's also stiff and big and more expensive. But you don't want to just like have a whole roll of 18 gauge wire, because that is not going to help you in many cases. If you have this, a butane soldering iron is a handy thing to have. These run on, you fill these up like a cigarette lighter, basically, and it's a soldering iron, but it works on butane instead of electricity. So it's good. You can use it anywhere, and you don't have to worry about wires. And you absolutely definitely want a multimeter. It does not have to be a fancy one. I like the yellow ones. I actually have an orange one, but you can get a decent one for about $20. And I like the digital displays, although the ones that are cheaper that have the needle do have some advantages over the ones with the digital display, because you can see a needle move from farther away. And if you're just trying to detect if something has voltage, that needle actually can be better. But any of those are fine. You just need to have one. And then finally, structural interior. You want to have a number of adhesive pads and Velcro strips for emergency repairs, some JB Weld or epoxy. This is a binary paste that you mix together and it forms a rock hard surface. JB Weld is one of these things that is amazing, and at the same time, it's easily abused. Also, I would have some clear Flex Seal, an emergency fix for leaks. Flex Seal is not a good long-term product, but if you have a leak in your roof, say around a ceiling vent or something like that, you can actually run Flex Seal around the edges and you will probably be good, at least until you can get somewhere where you can do a proper repair. I like to have a whole selection of screws, nuts, bolts. I like Zip screws, which are terrible, but they are easy and they work in most cases. You can use Zip screws, which are those very sharp screws that are typically used for decks. They're not a great solution to build your rig out of. A lot of people do. I mean, there's plenty of Zip screws in anything I've ever built. But they're great for emergencies because they will go through metal and wood and hold it together. Bungee cords. A bunch of bungee cords makes absolutely perfect sense for a whole bunch of reasons. Hose clamps are a good thing. They sell these kits of hose clamps. Those are a good thing to have. And then one thing I'll add that isn't on here. You need some kind of a wire. So, and I mean a heavy-duty wire. So you may have heard that farmers can repair anything in the world with duct tape and baling wire. Well, yeah, I mean, baling wire is really good stuff for a lot of things, like your muffler hangers have broken and you need to hold your muffler up to the vehicle. Well, you can't use zip ties for that because it's super hot, but you can use wire. And one source for this wire, which is a little odd, but has worked for me in many cases. In fact, when I was a farmer, this is what we used. These little flags you can buy in bulk. They're used to mark construction sites or whatever. They're just little metal rods with a tiny little plastic flag. That metal is exactly the right thickness that makes it easy to bend, but it's also strong enough to hold things together. So I have a kit of those in my van, and they're also good for like marking your camping spot or, you know, calling attention to the fact that there's a wire running on the ground or whatever. So rather than have a roll of wire, I just have a bunch of those flags and it serves the same purpose. So that's a bunch of stuff. Another thing I would add to that is some kind of an axe or a hand axe or something that is substantial that you can actually chop something with. People use these for defense. Yeah, there's that. But they're also a very important thing for real survival. When I took wilderness survival training back in the 80s, we were asked what was the most important thing to bring with you. And, you know, everyone was like, oh, a knife or, you know, food or a sleeping bag. No, the answer was an axe, because you can do everything with an axe. Anything you can do with a knife, you can do with an axe. And there's a lot of things you can do with an axe that you can't do with a knife. So for pure survival and just having something big and heavy that you can whack things with, an axe is a good idea. I have a hand axe, which people will mistakenly call a hatchet. Hatchets are a different thing. And I've used it all the time. I use it for putting in tent stakes, for cutting down branches, or whatever. Although, I do like having the saw in my multi-tool. And one last thing, some way to purify water. Water purification tablets, iodine, as previously mentioned, bleach, which is what I use, or even a life straw. You should have something. Resource recommendation. Hey, Jess also recommended this great resource, which is the first aid kit in your phone. Well, actually, it's the American Red Cross first aid app. The way you get this is with a text message. I mean, you can find it in your stores, but the simplest thing to do is text GET EMERGENCY as one word to number 90999. If you do that, you will get a link to this actually very, very good first aid app that will tell you all the information you need, such as like what to do if you get bit by a coral snake. So definitely, definitely add that to your phones and, you know, read it. Read it while you're sitting on the bathroom or whatever, but absorb that material so that you will have it when you absolutely need it. It works offline. It's not huge. It's fairly well organized, and I am very happy to have it. Oh, and just so you know, it'll ask you to sign in. You don't have to. You can just hit continue as guest, and it will go from there. But it's basically an alphabetic list of problems. So just quickly looking at it. Fevers, opioid overdose, seizures, shock. Okay, what do you do for shock? Shock. Check the scene for safety. Check for signs and symptoms. Call 911. Give care. And then the whole give care is a whole big section. It's very detailed. It's an excellent, excellent resource. Everybody should have this on their phone. So thank you very much, Jess. Probably the best suggestion of all. So folks, I'm going to call it. That's going to be the podcast for this week. I know it was weird, but it was such a lot of content that I didn't have a really good way to break it up and put it in there for you. So thank you very much for listening. Music, as always, though there was very little of it, is by Simon Wegg. Until next time, remember the words of, I actually don't know who said this, but it's interesting. They said, a part of kindness consists in loving people more than they deserve.